Well, welcome to another episode of the Doomer Optimism podcast. I'm first time host Donald, and I'm joined with Ashley, who's co-hosting today, and we're interviewing Jane Smith, who's if you look at a blog, you might recognize as famous actress Angelina Jolie. So yeah, this is Angelina Jolie's pseudonym, Jane Smith, and spelled in the PG Woodhouse style. And we're going to be talking today about keeping a home, and a review she wrote recently of Cheryl Mendelson's wonderful book, Home Comforts. And then maybe we'll also get into the joint review she wrote with her husband of The Ancient City, which I think actually the two reviews really complement each other. They talk about very similar things. So very funny to call you Jane, but could you briefly, while maintaining your pseudo anonymity, introduce yourself, maybe introduce the Mendelsohn book too?
Sure. So I am a housewife in the suburbs of a big American city. My husband and I have four kids. And over our Christmas break, I was telling him about some book I'd read, and he was telling me about some book he'd read. And I said, you know, we should have a Substack where we write book reviews. And so we did. We started one. It's The Smiths, with a P before the S, at substack.substack.com. And we've just started writing about stuff that we think about and stuff that we're interested in. And it's actually, I mean, you mentioned that our review of The Ancient City segues well into the one that I wrote more recently. But I found that it all works together really well, because it turns out, without really quite noticing it, over the last decade plus of you know, building a household and a family, we've come to think about a lot of the same things from very different angles. So it's been a great project for us to do together, to have something that we're working on besides our kids. So this review that I wrote, Home Comforts, is this massive, like 900 page book by a woman named Cheryl Mendelsohn, who went to Harvard Law School and went to graduate school in philosophy, and then decided that she was going to keep house, that was, you know, the thing that was going to be really meaningful to her, and wrote a book that was meant to be a reference work. She's got, you know, chapters on how to clean various fabrics, and, you know, how to make sure that you're not going to give anybody food poisoning, and, you know, how frequently you should vacuum, and how you should change your bed sheets twice a week, which, like, goodness knows I don't do. but she also has some really beautiful meditations on why this matters and why this is actually important and valuable work, not just, you know, stuff that has to get done, but stuff that can actually provide meaning and be a worthwhile undertaking for somebody who went to Harvard Law School. And so I've been thinking about this on and off for you know, a decade, but more actively for a couple of months, because a guy I know said, you know, hey, you've been home with your kids, you know, you like being home with your kids. No woman I know think that would be like a good way to live their lives when they get married and have kids. You know, has anybody written anything explaining like why this is actually a useful, valuable, you know, satisfying thing to do? And I went looking to see if I could find something to send him. And I basically couldn't. So I decided that I should probably write it myself. So I did in the, I mean, the nice thing about book reviews is that sometimes you can say, hey, this is a fun book, you should read it because you'll enjoy it. But they're really mostly a launching pad to riff on something interesting that you've been thinking about and that you sort of took away from the book without it necessarily being something that the book is about. Because Cheryl Mendelson's book is about keeping house. It's not specifically about parenting or about how you structure your household and what sort of lifestyle choices you make. It's, you know, it's applicable to single people, it's applicable to retirees, it's applicable to, I'm so sorry, that is the timer for my bread. Okay. I just made it go in. Sorry, very on brand here. I multitasking.
Well, while you take your bread out of the oven, just a few notes of praise for your review and the Mendelsohn book. There's a recent genre of writing that I don't know what else to call it. This like sort of neo-trad wife genre. And then Evie Magazine. I don't know if either of you have seen that. And it's all very, it doesn't speak to me at all. I mean, it's not meant to, I guess, but it's all very strange. And it seems to be written by people who just think about it in a really abstract way, but don't actually have children yet, or something like that. I don't know. I can't quite put my finger on what's wrong with it. But what
it's almost like fetishizing in some ways, if that's the right word. It's like placing a mirror placing a projected fantasy onto what it is. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know if that helps, but that's what it seems like to me.
But what I think your review doesn't have strike that tone at all, and nor does the Mendelsohn book, and in a good way. And what at the beginning of the Mendelsohn book, one of the things I like about it is she talks about her grandmothers. She has a British grandmother and Italian grandmother, both of whom had very opposite approaches to keeping house. The funniest one is that, so the British grandmother, everything is tight, tightened up, and she makes her beds very strictly. And the Italian grandmother thinks sheets need to breathe. So, you know, you don't make your bed super tight. And so she has to balance the two. But she has these two excellent models of people for whom, you know, keeping a good house is was a way of life and a something important. So that's not a question. I apologize. But it's just the tone of both her book and... like there's a line in the Don DeLillo novel that it's hard to be serious, it's easy to be too serious. Mm-hmm. And I think you're able to thread that needle.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's a topic where it's hard to avoid being argumentative or defensive. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of you know, the mommy wars are such a presence in, you know, I would say American women, I think, you know, sort of Western women generally as lives. You know, is it better to do this or to do that? You know, whatever you do, somebody is going to tell you that you're doing it wrong. And so I really wanted writing this not to argue that this is a better way of living your life, but to paint a picture of why it's a good way. Because, yeah. You know, I don't know you. I don't know your life. I don't know why, you know, you make whatever choices you do. But I do think that many more people would be happy and more satisfied in their lives if they spent more time thinking about keeping house and about making a home for themselves and their families. So statistically, any given young woman, you know, would probably be happier doing this, but you know, no person is a statistic. We get a lot of pictures in our society of what success looks like in the workplace or in society, you know, in you know, what kinds of parties you get invited to and who is going to date you and, you know, what promotions you get. And we don't get a lot of pictures of what satisfaction and the good life look like in the home. And this is something that both men and women, you know, get a tremendous amount of satisfaction out of, and that is important and meaningful. But it's especially important when there are kids in the picture, and it's especially, and therefore it becomes especially important for women, because you know, we have a different relationship with our children than men do.
Yep. Okay, so typically I like the arc of these individual shows to kind of follow, like, a lay out the doom, and then what is the issue that we're dealing with, what are we up against, and then what is the, like, optimistic vision to respond to the doom, so the doomer optimism arc. So I wonder if we might just, like, set the stage by hearing you talk a little bit about, like, the way you see, like, the kinds of narratives the women are told, like, go into, I guess, some more detail about, yeah, like, just the what we're up against to being able to, like, I don't know, I guess get a more widespread understanding of homemaking as worthwhile, worthy, like, high status, satisfying, you know, all, like, what are we up against to like achieving that goal first?
Okay, so one aspect of it, I think, is that we denigrate physical labor. You know, the things that we outsource are things that are not particularly thinky and are very physical. You know, gardening is like a cool hobby, but when you're spreading, you know, like a ton of mulch, that's what you're going to hire somebody to do. In the same way, you know, people get very into brewing kombucha or making sourdough or whatever, but scrubbing toilets is the kind of thing that we hire other people to do. Mm-hmm. And those aren't actually separate spheres of life. You know, we're enormously lucky that housekeeping is so much less labor intensive than it was, you know, 100 or 200 years ago. Like, we have washing machines, we have vacuum cleaners, you know, we have heat that doesn't leave a fine layer of coal dust over everything in the house. So it's a lot easier than it used to be. But there's a very strong strain, especially in sort of, you know, professional managerial class, you know, highly educated, coastal elite, whatever you want to call it, society, that, you know, doing stuff with your hands or your body, that's not, you know, artisanal and, you know, exciting and gonna give you something, you know, cool you can put on your mantelpiece at the end of it, is just, like, pointless. That it's, you know, something that we pay immigrants to do. And I think you see that nowhere more than in housekeeping. This idea that you are, you know, wasting your college education, wasting your graduate degree, wasting the thing that you've, you know, undertaken $100,000 worth of debt to get by vacuuming Cheerio crumbs out of the carpet. And, you know, if life were with nothing but vacuuming Cheerio crumbs out of the carpet, I would say, you know, yeah, true. That's a pretty crummy life. No pun intended.
I was just thinking that.
I swear I didn't do that on purpose. But the vacuuming Cheerio crumbs is part of creating a home that works, that, you know, people have the things they need when they need them. And, you know, the other people who live with you, but, like, also you, you know, if you live by yourself, you know, like, you are a person of value who deserves to be taken care of. And, you know, that's a thing that you can do for yourself. And, you know, we've decided as a society, or, you know, spheres of society have decided that, that these things are either not important at all, like, they don't have to be done, or that they are demeaning to the people who do them. And, you know, if you have the means to avoid demeaning tasks, why wouldn't you? You know, maybe you would avoid them for ethical reasons because, you know, like it's bad to put off these demeaning things on, you know, other people. But like most of the time, you just like, if you think that something is like a terrible thing to have to do, you're going to look for ways to avoid it. So the sort of image of what a successful life looks like is really caught up in the workplace, in sort of the intellectual world. You know, like getting an article in The Atlantic is awesome. You know, making senior vice president is awesome. And, you know, like obviously you have a house because you have somewhere you need to go, but you know, sleep and eat, but you know, that's just kind of a side story. And that's become increasingly true over the last 100, 200 years because we've begun to separate, you know, production from the home because we've got this tremendous technological surplus and specialization. And, you know, when you don't have to weave your own cloth and sew your own clothes, you can get clothes a heck of a lot cheaper and a heck of a lot faster. But our homes are still these places that give us meaning, that are our first schools, that are where we live out, you know, the most sort of private and important parts of our lives, and even the public parts of our lives. You know, sometimes we entertain in our homes. We have our, you know, we see our friends. We're certainly around our families. You know, these are important places that shouldn't get kind of like pushed to the side as a sideline, as a as something to, you know, like, yeah, we'll deal with that when we get to it. These are the first places and the fundamental places that our children are. And they're also, you know, increasingly the places where we're spending huge amounts of our time.
So
I have an added comment, and then Donald, you ask a question, but like, I just think about the professional managerial class women that I know. And part of it is just like, this is the script. You hire a nanny or you get your kids in daycare, you hire out house care, housework, whatever, a cleaning service. You hire out landscapers. And that's what everybody else of your class does. And part of my doom, the doom for me at least, is just like, I think just like providing an alternative option that is more like agency centered. And my own personal experience, I don't think I was actually sure what I was going to do with my career when I had my first in grad school. But once I had my first child, I was like, oh, I just need to be around. Like, I just need to be around. This is an infant. This kid needs me. And then I had two more kids. And so there's just a period of time where I was like, you know, I just need to be around. These kids are, it's really important that I'm there for them. I think it helped also that I was a nanny for these like upper class women in Chicago before I became a mom. And they were just never home. They were like not home from 6:30 a.m. till 7 p.m. And I was like, I won't have kids if that's what my job is like. Or I just, yeah, I'll quit the job if I want to have kids. So anyways, I just think like, there, part of what we see in doomer optimism is like this. A lot of times people reach a crisis point where the standard expectation for what their life is going to be is just like butting up against their instinct and like drive for some more meaning in life. And then they have this like alternative exploration phase. But yeah, part of me, like just an observation, the doom is partially just everyone else does it. It's normalized. Like, where do you send your kids to daycare? And that's just the expectation that 6 weeks in, they'll be gone and you'll be back to work. And you fire everything out.
Yeah, that's another big thing that I was hoping that this piece will do. And, you know, I think so far it's mostly just, hit people who already sort of agree. But, you know, I hope that this guy who asked me, you know, months ago to write something, you know, can send this to people he's chatting with and have an alternative script or an alternative model to say, you know, like, yeah, you know, it's hard to imagine what your life is going to look like if you're not going for that big job, because everybody at the office is going for that big job. We live in not just incredibly sort of class stratified societies, but incredibly age stratified societies and incredibly sort of lifestyle stratified societies. You know, I know a ton of other moms who are home because I've chosen to live my life in a way that sort of works well with me being home. You know, the other moms at our school are. And so it's really hard to sort of jump from one track to another, or even more to sort of blaze your own track because you don't have anybody to copy.
Mm-hmm. So I read all these books to my daughters, that my older daughter especially, that I never read growing up because I had brothers. So the Laura Ingalls Wilder books and the Betsy Tacy Tip books and all these things. And I think that they offer a really interesting window into domestic life in an earlier America. And that I think in some ways, the move away from the kind of physical labor you describe in the home has actually made it harder, because now moms and parents generally spend way more time watching their kids directly than they did in the past. It's fascinating. You read Betsy, Tacy, and Tib. The parents are almost, you know, almost never see the moms. The moms are baking and canning fruits and vegetables and gardening and spending time with each other. They watch the babies, but as soon as the babies are big enough to be watched by the older kids, the kids are out of the house and are in a world of children, because there are lots of children around. And the kids are in a world of children with very, very little parent supervision. The moms are at home and they are making and mending clothes. They're preparing food, they're preserving food, they're making plans, they're just hanging out with each other. So there was a world of women, an entire sphere of life in which women were autonomous and totally dictated the terms of that world. And there was a world of children, which had very little parental supervision at all. So parental authority was much clearer. And corresponding to that authority, children had way more freedom, a lesson which unfortunately has been completely forgotten, that very clear authority corresponds to more freedom. But both those worlds, for the most part, of women and children have disappeared and become commingled also in a way that they weren't previously. And I think that, at least for me, like spending a whole day with a 2-year-old.
Oh, it's brutal.
Way harder, way more draining, more tiring than spending a whole day digging, like moving rocks and digging or something. You know, like the hardest physical labor.
Yeah.
Is much easier than spending a whole day watching a toddler and like having that pay attention to a toddler and keep a toddler occupied. And so I think in a lot of ways, the movement away from physical tasks has been replaced by a way more intensive parenting that's a lot harder. But also, there just aren't a lot of kids around. I mean, just thinking about my immediate vicinity, we have one other neighbor with kids the same age as our kids. There is no world of children that we can send our kids out into.
So we moved almost 2 years ago now. And the neighborhood that we moved to is one where we already knew several families with kids our kids' ages. And one of the greatest blessings of the new neighborhood has been that, you know, kids come and knock at our door and say, you know, hey, you want to play? And they all run off together to the park and splash in the creek and come home completely soaked and covered in mud. And, you know, I host them off in the yard and then we have dinner. You know, I love my kids and I love hanging out with them. My oldest is now old enough that we can do things that I am interested in for their own sake. We're reading Lord of the Rings together, or we're reading it separately, but trying to, you know, pace ourselves so we can talk about it. But, you know, there are a few things that I would more prefer to avoid than an afternoon of playing Barbies. Like, I loved that when I was 5 years old. I am no longer 5 years old. Like, I am ready to, you know, move on to like a new phase in my existence. And so, you know, that does exist, the world of children and the world of parents that is separate from children. But it's hard to find because, you know, so many people are at the office all day. And, you know, like, I know a lot of really nice nannies, but they don't want to hang out with me, you know, which is like perfectly reasonable. You know, they are living, you know, sort of in, there's a, right, like in a lot of neighborhoods, there's also like the world of nannies as from the world of moms or the world of children. Sorry, I was just grabbing this book because I was trying to find the citation, but there is a woman in the 1970s, a sociologist who, her name is Judith Brown, and she wrote this very short article where she says that the thing that decides what is women's work in a given society is what is compatible with caring for children. So in societies where agriculture is done, you know, with a digging stick, agriculture or horticulture is women's work. In societies with the plow, it's men's work because you can't plow with a toddler. You know, you can't stop in time if they get in the way. You know, it's not something that can be easily interrupted. And so much work in our society is now the kind of thing that can't be done with a toddler. You know, there's this, you know, online dichotomy that some jobs are farm and some jobs are emails. And, you know, I don't think there's very much email work that can be done effectively with a toddler. You know, you can do it. You know, I've managed to write a Substack with a toddler, although usually, you know, when he's napping. Yeah. But, you know, if it's like your job that you're trying to, you know, get in a good 8 hours of, that's not something that you can put down every 2 minutes. It's not something you can do while also, you know, explaining why we don't climb into the dishwasher. And there just are no more jobs, at least high status jobs in America, that can be done while also providing effective childcare. Which is why, you know, there isn't this kind of world of women anymore, or why, when it exists, it's occupied by women who have intentionally opted out of the high status work because there is no more high status physical work.
Mm-hmm. I would just add one of the things there's so many parallels here to homesteading and like just, you know, small scale production in the home. And I think it's just worth noting explicitly that like, there was a whole social structure around homesteading, like what you were describing, Donald. There's a whole social structure around like a small amount of subsistence that that functioned in a way that the nuclear family from the 50s doesn't. And so a lot of times, like, we moderns are so confused because we want to like return, but to what era are we trying to return to? Almost everybody I know is like, who's in this little doomer optimism sphere, has gone through a period where they were like, oh my gosh, modernity is horrible for all of us. What can we do about it? And then they like just start looking back in history. And I think most people eventually have like an anarcho-primitivist stage where they're like, we just need to go back to hunter-gatherers somehow. Like the printing press was really the thing that was to blame, like the written word and blah, blah, blah. Like just, we should never have started writing. And then like, you realize you have like okay, but there's actually, like, we actually do live in a civilization, and to be able to raise kids and have them be in it, you have to compromise somehow. So anyways, I just think it's kind of funny because a lot of times people will be like, yeah, I want to return, I want to be in the home, but like the nuclear family's a weird 1950s, 60s, living in the suburbs, like wage labor world that actually wasn't very functional relative to earlier periods. And it's just hard, like you were saying, I think it's just, you can want those social structures to exist, and sometimes you can find a neighborhood like you have and they exist, but a lot of times you don't, and so then there is a period where you're like looking to be more in the home, and then you're like, a lot of women are going through this individually, like, I feel like I'm the only person in the world who's sitting home with this two-year-old, and I'm supposed to be like totally satisfied by this, but this is also kind of excruciating. I think maybe less so, and I want to be with her, it's less so than the email job would be and putting her in daycare would be, but this also isn't functional. So I think like it's just a really good point to bring up the contours of that, like there are different social periods that we look back to.
Yeah, and you know, even before you get to the Ma Ingalls, I forget what Betsy and Tacy's mom's names are, period, you get to a time when, you know, the men are at home too. You know, they're not house husbands. They're not, you know, cooking and cleaning, but, you know, production happened in the home, either, you know, because you were living on a farm or because your house was, you know, upstairs from your shop. And, you know, so you're making your saddles or your books or whatever it is, and you've got your servants and you've got your apprentices and you've got your wife and you've got your children, and everybody is just way more integrated in everybody else's lives. You know, this was one of the, both the nice things and the difficult things about the period that, you know, we all spent at home in 2020, that suddenly we were in each other's world. My husband and I were in each other's worlds much more than we had been. I was pregnant with our fourth kid during the pandemic, and he was like, oh, your morning sickness is so much worse than it was with the others. And I'm like, no, it's not. You're just during the day. But, you know, again, jobs that are not actually the kind of thing that you can, you know, interrupt every 2 minutes because there's a two-year-old in the room, are much more difficult to do with a two-year-old in the house. And, you know, when he was able to go back to his office, we were all much, much happier, because the house could run and the office could run, and, you know, ne'er the twain shall meet except when it's take your child to work day. And, you know, but at the same time, like, I missed the times that we were able to work on projects together. You know, we built this enormous play structure in like April of 2020. And I was like, oh man, you know, this is what society used to be like, is, you know, like the whole family working together on a project. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and I wonder which of our children would have died before the age of five in the societies where, you know, they hadn't managed to produce enough surplus to have things like antibiotics. So, right, the doomer optimism challenge is to move to a point that we can, like, keep the good stuff, but have the newer good stuff, to conserve the good stuff and innovate our way out of the bad stuff from the past. And, you know, reading history and thinking about, you know, wow, which of these like points, which of these family structures and household structures seem the most appealing to me. Like, we don't actually have a time machine. So, right, the trick is to try and find which things are good and how you can reinvent those and bring those to your life. You know, you talk a lot about homesteading and agriculture and sort of return to models of technological life that are, you know, more resilient. And, you know, my family, my husband runs a tech company. Like, we are way up at the tippy top of what's going to crumble if the collapse comes. But there's also sort of social resilience. And, you know, right, like we may not have reached peak oil, but we've definitely reached, as a society, like peak family formation, you know, totally. Probably yep. decades ago. We've lost or intentionally abandoned without sort of realizing everything we were losing with it. So much of what lets us be resilient and independent and secure and sort of go out into the world and do stuff, whether it's start a farm or, you know, make a friend or, you know, find a spouse, that I think taking some of that homesteading mindset and that, you know, like, let's figure out how people used to do this stuff and whether we can come up with a, you know, more efficient way of doing it. And taking that to the realm of our social interactions is as important as mm-hmm. figuring out how to, you know, live off the grid.
And I think it's all connected. I mean, if your house is a mess, you're really, you know, you don't feel good about bringing people to it. You know, especially like newer friends, you know. It's hard to, you know, if you know someone real well, it's like, oh, my house is a mess, but, you know, whatever, it's okay. But, like, bringing friends into the home when, if your home feels to you, like, chaotic and unstable, it's hard to bring people into it. I'm always struck by how antisocial American life has become. That, you know, middle class American life used to involve lots of parties and yeah. lots of hosting and lots of visiting, never mind, you know, an even earlier form of, you know, I think that social complexity and technological complexity are inversely correlated. Mm-hmm. And that's very clear, like you read Proust or something, of how complex social life used to be, that very subtle things had all kinds of meaning. And read Jane Austen, any of these things, that social life very complex, and it's social complexity has decreased a lot, and people are just, you know I go walking in the neighborhood a lot with my family and my kids in the evenings, and other than dog walkers, how rare it is to even see people, even on a nice evening. People mm-hmm. are really shut in to their homes. And I don't know how to turn that around. I mean, maybe we could talk a little bit about the optimism side about what sort of you describe very well, like how you've managed to create a life in your home. But I wonder if we could talk about sort of projecting that outward to other people about that, and also how we can turn around this social thing that we've fallen into.
I think a lot of the lack of sociability is just how totally wiped people are, and how little slack there is in everybody's lives. You see these statistics about how many American families can absorb an unexpected cost, mm-hmm. like financial cost, you know, like, do you have enough savings that if you got hit by a car and were in the hospital, you know, you would be okay. But there's also, you know, would you be able to eat? Like, not would you be able to afford money, but like afford food, but, you know, like, would there be somebody who would bring you food? Would there be, you know, somebody who could, you know, like feed your cat? And, you know, more and more people don't have that, or don't have that unless, you know, somebody would be like wildly inconveniencing themselves to do it. The one of the sort of biggest reasons to stay home or to sort of structure your life that way is that it introduces slack into the system. It, you know, it's not a, you know, 9-to-5 job. Like, there is a lot of downtime. There's also a lot of uptime in the middle of the night. But it means that when something unexpected happens to you, to someone in your social circle, you can absorb it without, you know, everything going completely berserk. You know, how to do this on like a, you know, like America-wide level, I have no idea. I the best answer I can give is, you know, be a good model for the people around you. And, you know, like do change begins at home, you know, do what, will make a difference, you know, on a small local level. And, you know, hopefully people kind of pick that up and run with it. You know, be the change you want to see. Like I'm just full of stupid. Because one of the nice things about being a housewife is that I can sit here and think like, what's going to work for my small society, you know, my family, my neighborhood, my church, you know, maybe like my town, but you know, it's like even a smallish town is not really a human scale thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, this struck me very powerfully at the beginning of the pandemic when everybody had very strong opinions about what government policies should be here and there, and like, you know, figuring out what you should do for your family and like what your personal behavior should be was not necessarily easy, but it was tremendously easier than figuring out what the rules should be for everybody at large. And you know, I don't think anybody was universally thrilled with the pandemic response, and probably in lots of different directions. But the way that, you know, like, I'm not sure there was a way that you could have made policy for a country of 300 million people that were, you know, for an individual state that was gonna work effectively, just because that's not a human scale institution. Mm-hmm. So one answer is that, you know, we should work on finding more of our meaning and more of our status from human scale institutions, from, you know, groups of people that are small enough that you can know, if not all of them, then many of them. And we should work on, you know, questioning the scripts that we're given. You know, staying home is low status. You know, Cheryl Mendelson talks about this, and it's like, you know, nobody wants to talk to you at a cocktail party if you say you're a housewife. And, you know, I've actually found that housewife is a better line than stay-at-home mom, because if you say, oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom, everybody's like, oh, that's great, kids are so great, and, you know, like wanders off. And if you say you're a housewife, they're like, whoa. Like, you know, like that's just not a thing that people say in 2023. So in that brief moment that the wires are crossed, you can be like, hey, you know, what do you think about, you know, evidence that Neanderthals engaged in cannibalism? And totally. You know, but it gives you an opportunity to strike up a conversation about something that is actually interesting to you. Whereas, you know, what is your job generally isn't.
Yeah, so I just have some thoughts. First of all, what you're saying sounds so much like what we constantly repeat on here, not just with homesteading, but like all sort of like wicked problems that we face, that thinking about solutions on a human scale, thinking about solutions that are like locally specific to whatever problem you're facing. So like figuring out your own life, figuring out the smallest possible sphere and moving out from there is something we talk about all the time. That's like so great. I really wonder how to make that high status. That's something that's just gonna always kind of be in my head, like how to make this something like, look at how wonderful and cool this is, that there was this problem we were presented with and then we like used our ingenuity and we solved the problem, and that's like a really cool thing and people can follow this model. I also want to point out, I love the point you made about the social slack. It used to be that women would be like, women who were not in the workplace would be like running civic organizations and like weaving together the loose ends of society, like that nobody else has time. The men who are in like a wage position or a salaried position wouldn't have time to be really like thinking about, and they would be getting together and be getting together for other purposes, like fundraiser for the church or something like that, and just like weaving together, well, this problem has presented itself, like what can we do about it? So I love the idea that that's like one way to get there without knowing specifically what there looks like for everybody, but instead like the way to get there is just simply through trying to work out the problem by yourself with your family and with other people who are also interested in that problem. I feel like is great. It's not satisfying to people because it's like, just figure it out. The solution is not and neither is for homesteading. It's not like just buy this kit and you'll be a homesteader. It's like, well, where do you live? What do you want to produce? What are your goals with this? What are your whole family, you know, everything that's going on with your family and the other limitations. The other thing I just want to point out is the Italian grandmother versus the British grandmother thing, which is, I think that there is just so many ways a healthy home can look. And I think it's just really important to point out, especially with the mommy wars, everybody wants to have like some weird like prototype or archetype. And then they get really weird about it and like fetishize it. And then it becomes like an Instagram theme or something. And I just want to point out the few things that we did, just in case it's helpful, as people are thinking about different models. One, we did do like a lot of attachment parenting, which actually does like harken back to hunter gatherer days. So I didn't lose my whole anarcho primitivist, self. We did like baby wearing and, you know, natural childbirth and, you know, baby led weaning, extended breastfeeding, that kind of stuff. I think the neighborhoods, if you can find them, are great. Like, you know, child-centered neighborhoods are a great way to recreate that world of childhood. We don't really have that. But having some place that's like a child-centered place, like we have a library we go to every week and the kids kind of just run crazy and the parents just talk to each other. So those kind of routine child-centered world, like even in churches or different, you know, after school activities, whatever. The other thing I wrote about for, sorry, I'm making this an interview about myself. Nobody asked me. But the other thing I wrote about in Front Porch Republic is I read something from like a money blogger in like the 2007-08 era, that was like, you could think about retirement in different ways. Like you don't have to think about working your whole life and then retiring at 65 or 68 or whatever. You could take mini retirements throughout your life, to dedicate to something that's non full. I basically took a mini retirement while our kids were in like the infant stages, and now are like getting back into ramping up our work as they're getting older. So that's one option for people like in the modern context. And then the other thing is just, we do like homesteading, and in theory, although we're not producing really enough for this to work, but in theory, some amount of home production could lead to like what they call in sociology a downshifting, meaning you can work less, consume less if you produce more. Then your total number of work hours as a family or as a couple can be lowered. So I think that's another strategy that I think a lot of people just don't really think that much about, but like you could potentially, you know, work less if you try to lower your consumption and increase your production, even if it's a little bit at home. So, yeah. Sorry.
No, I mean, nobody asked me. There are so many different ways of having your family work well. Having your home work well. And, you know, I'm conflating home and family here, but I hope that it's sort of obvious why those are intimately connected. You know, it depends on the personalities of the people. It depends on, you know, the personalities and the needs of the people. You know, a family with a child with, you know, serious medical issues is going to work very, very differently than, you know, a family with like five, you know, athletic teenagers, you know, not least because the parents can do a lot less physical labor with the athletic teenagers in the house. And, you know, one thing that often comes up when women start talking about being home or having a job is that this becomes such a dichotomy. It's this idea that, you know, either you're at home paying attention to your kids 24/7, or, you know, you're working in, you know, some high powered career and, you know, your children are being, you know, watched by a nanny or your husband or whatever. And those aren't the only choices. And exactly which of those choices you make isn't even really the most important question. Right. The question and the thing that should be at the forefront of people's minds, and especially people who, you know, aren't married yet and don't have kids yet, and are trying to figure out, you know, what they should do right now to kind of get their lives on the track for the kind of life they want in the future, is just where your priorities are. Once you have, you know, like corporations have, you know, their statement of values and, you know, we want integrity, whatever. I knew a guy who had a Enron corporate principles plaque from, you know, back in the day before they, this is like one of his prized possessions. but, you know, that's a reasonable thing to have as a person. I mean, not like on a plaque because that would be weird, but, you know, like, what is it that is actually important to you? Because as your circumstances change, you may find that whatever path you are following doesn't actually, you know, lead in that direction. You know, is self-sufficiency really important to you? Is being, you know, super connected with the people around you really important to you? Is having a lot of like downtime by yourself where you can just like breathe and think really important to you? And, you know, how do you maintain those things that you really care about, that are, that really matter? Because chances are really good that just doing what everybody else is doing is not going to allow you to live the kind of life that you want to live, because you're not everybody else and your circumstances aren't everybody else's. And also, like, most people are just not very happy. So copying what they're doing is not actually like a good path forward.
And realizing you have agency
so
to make choices.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's huge.
Such an important thing. And I mean, just thinking about my own life, I feel like when my wife and I had our first kid, I was working and commuting to grad school, and it was insane, you know?
Yeah.
She was working, and then her mom was watching the baby, and it was completely unsustainable and didn't make any sense. And we were all unhappy, you know, we were all unhappy with it. And it's taken us a while to move more towards a situation. Like, my wife's a therapist, she was working at a hospital, and then, you know, now she has a private practice, so she can work fewer days, just work, you know, and set her own hours, and you know, we've moved closer to what we want, but, you know, we keep tinkering with it, but realizing that it's up to you, you know, it sounds strange to say, but it, you know, that there's no, the these sort of automatic tracks that people find themselves on, like K-12 and then college, and then some people, you know, you get recruited to a job while in college, and then, you know, next thing you know, you're 39 and you're looking around, you know, what happened? I think that that's actually fairly common.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially with a lot of, you know, professional jobs where there's a very clear track. You know, you, if you want to be a lawyer, you know, you go to law school and then you're an associate, and then, you know, or, you know, med school is even more dramatic that way. And, you know, like, I was very into school as a kid. Like, I loved school. I loved, you know, well, I didn't love doing my homework, but I, you know, I loved like having this very clear structure. And stepping outside of that as an adult, and, you know, not only was I not going into one of these careers that has a very clearly defined set of steps, but I was even stepping outside of you know, steps in general. I was stepping outside of, you know, anybody else telling me, you know, this is what your life is going to look like, and these are the boxes you need to check. You know, was terrifying.
Yeah.
And having to sort of figure out for yourself, what does success look like? And, you know, where, like, how do you spend your time? How do you create your own structure? Was really, really difficult. You know, having one baby is like the hardest stage of life, because yeah. they are so much work and yet they are so boring.
Yes.
I mean, they're wonderful, but like, they are so boring. And, you know, nobody believes me when I say this, but like, having a whole bunch of kids with a baby is just like way, way, way easier than
oh, yeah.
having one baby, because, you know, there's like other stuff going on. You know, you might be busy. It might be hard to, you know, catch a moment to sit down, but like, that's way better than having nothing to do but sit down
and look at the baby the whole time. Like, oh my yeah. God, how many pictures did I have of my first kid just like laying there? Like, I don't even have, and it's just the cliche, but I have like no, relatively way fewer of my third, just sitting in various chairs her whole like it was like, what were you doing at that time? Okay, so yeah, I would say totally agree. I mean, with any of this doomer optimism stuff, we say like, have agency, figure it out. And you actually do get tougher when you kind of push yourself and figure those things out. But there is a period of adaptation that's tough, and it's, there's not no real way around it. But it's okay, because it's like your life, and what else are you supposed to be doing but like find the best way to live it. But just to be gentle with yourself throughout as you're figuring it out. The other thing I wanted to ask you about. Donald mentioned the Ancient City review. I wonder if we could talk about if you're okay, Donald, with me moving in this direction. What hangs the Substack together? Like, what is the interest of you and your husband now that you're a decade into the family project? Like, what are some of these themes you're exploring?
So when I suggested we start the Substack, it was because I had read this book about dead languages, which, you know, if you go and look at the Substack, it's the very first post. It's a fun book, and I, you know, I highly recommend it. But like, my takeaway was basically, this is a fun book and I highly recommend it. And so, you know, I said to my husband, let's do Substack. And he's like, that's great. You know, it's what a great idea. And like, we're chatting about it at breakfast, tell people about fun books. But it's turned out that, you know, just sort of looking at the books that we have both been reading and thinking about, that we're both thinking a lot about institutions and culture and knowledge and how these shape one another, and how sort of the ways that we live our lives encode this tacit knowledge, and how that can be sort of accepted or rejected. I mean, you know, some of it is just like, hey, I read this cool book, and, you know, my interests and his interests don't always align. The post that just went up today, he wrote about this book on Galois theory, which is a branch of mathematics. And so, you know, there's all these people who came and like read what I had to say about being a housewife. And now I'm like, surprise, here's what my husband thinks about math. you know, what ended up tying it together was kind of our shared interest in like how society and culture work, and how that works itself out in various different spheres of life. So it, you know, it's mostly like either I write something or he writes something, but occasionally we'll have something that we've read together, and we'll just like write it in the form of emails to each other and conversation that we're having together. So this review of The Ancient City is a book written in the 1860s by this French classicist, and he's going through, you know, how did the ancient city work? You know, we have this idea of what, you know, the golden age of Athens, or like the very late Roman Republic looked like, but that was building on, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of culture and history and just like weirdness. You know, we you know, you read the Dolores Book of Greek Myths and it's got, you know, these pretty pictures and these very clear stories. But that's not actually sort of the substrate of ancient life. And the argument that the guy who wrote this book, his name is Foustel de Coulanges, the argument that Foustel de Coulanges makes is that the fundamental religion of the ancient world is basically ancestor worship. And so the fundamental institution of the ancient world is the family in a very, I mean, I want to say patriarchal, in a, you know, but like really, really patriarchal, like the head of the family is the father, and he has the power of life and death over not just his, you know, infant children, but, you know, his like grown son's wife. And it's not, you know, because he's like got the biggest stick, it's because he is, you know, the representative of this ancestral cult. And then the city grows out of an extension of this cult, of the family, to, you know, be itself this incredibly totalitarian social thing. Like every aspect of life is ruled by the religion. And so, you know, this is like a kind of interesting way of thinking about how the ancient world works. And it's also a really interesting way of, because, you know, obviously that's not like how we live our lives. I mean, like we moderns, but also like my family personally, like, you know, I do not present my newborn children to my husband for him to decide whether they should be permitted to live. Like that's not cool. You shouldn't do that either. But the image of the family in the ancient world as this kind of thing that persists through time and is its own organism, and the sort of people who are currently alive being just like the part of that organism that's currently kind of moving around and like pouring out libations for the ancestors, but like only unique and different because it's the part that's currently moving, is like a useful corrective to the incredibly atomized way that we think about families now. You know, we have this narrative about like, oh, you know, your family's toxic, cut them off. Like, you know, you're your own person. Like we, you know, families are practically voluntary organizations at this point. And so this book is like interesting and useful, kind of shoving us back more towards a sensible medium.
I haven't read the Coulanges book, but I'm curious what how he talks about the relationship of men and women. Just thinking about Homer, how women not only existed in a separate social sphere, but literally inhabited a different part of a physically different part of the home in which men weren't allowed to enter. That, you know, it. Have either of you read Ivan Illich's Gender?
Yeah, I read parts of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating book. But one of the things that he really draws out is that in gendered societies, it's not that men rule over women or women rule over men, but that they are that they exist in a parallel way, but with actually fairly little overlap. Like that the idea of men giving orders to women, which started happening as that broke down in the modern world, was very scandalous because it had never happened before. He gives it funny examples of that. But in these, at least in ancient literature, that women existed in a whole separate sphere of the home, which men couldn't enter. The famous scenes in the Iliad in which a man is like invited and he stops at the doorway. He doesn't know what to do. It's a scandalous scandalous thing. I'm curious if what Coulanges says about that, about men and women's relationship to each other.
He doesn't really talk a lot about women, unfortunately. You know, there's a strain in modern history writing that is sort of to, you know, focus only on women, and especially on women as, you know, subaltern and oppressed. And let's look at these examples of women who are, you know, subverting this paradigm. And I don't care for that particularly, but I really, you know, also get frustrated with the work that focuses only on men's lives. And Coulanges does that to a pretty substantial degree. I mean, he talks a little bit about what marriage means and sort of the woman leaving the religion of her ancestors and coming to her husband's hearth and, you know, beginning to, you know, venerate his ancestors and raise her children to venerate his ancestors. But he's really interested in public life and at sort of what citizenship in the city means. And that's really exclusively a male concern. Yeah. So I would love, you know, is sort of equally erudite philosophically interesting look at what life was like for women. But I don't know that you have the textual evidence to, you know, Coulanges draws really heavily on like Cicero, and, you know, there's no female version of Cicero who's writing about, you know, what goes on for women. And for the home, yeah.
In the, you know, in the sort of modern nostalgia for the past, you have that this very silly idea that the past was an idea of female subservience to men. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually, there's probably more women now who are made subservient to men only because they happen to be in workplaces with male bosses. Than in the past, that like female subservience to men seems to me a really modern phenomenon, actually, and that the past is marked, well, that everyone's lives were harder in many ways, as you note, just because everyone was doing physical labor all the time to survive, and, you know, everyone is having to bury children who die and so on. Yes, we can pause.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. I just went to the bathroom. I'll be right back. Yeah.
No, that's fine. I actually wanna. Well, we, you know what? Wait. I was gonna say, like, just pause this or pause the recording, but don't do it. We'll
just note wherever this is.
Yeah, we'll make a note,
and then we'll come.
I also want to pull up this. Why isn't it letting me? Log on to Twitter. That's weird. I want to look up this quote from The Need to Be Whole, that's specifically about this thing you're bringing up, because he talks about the difference between men and women, and I thought,
oh, it was, yeah, in the chapter we're reading,
yeah,
everyone
for the last
agreed to a schedule and then can't do.
Yeah, I don't know, I don't get it. Maybe I'll look at my phone.
I could go grab the book, but
I have it very well, very clear in a tweet, paraphrased.
Hey, thanks. Sorry.
Okay. Well, we'll go back and just subtract these minute or whatever from the final recording we released. Okay. Yeah, but anyway, so I was just saying that, yeah, that how annoying it is to me that in both pro and anti, we have this projection onto the past of an idea of female subservience to men, when the bigger reality is it was basically everyone's subservience to nature of having to do lots of labor and just faced with necessity, but that the social life was primarily of male and female autonomy separate from one another. Obvious there's overlap mainly through marriage, and that men and women existing in separate spheres in which it would have been socially totally unacceptable for men to dictate how women live their lives. We no, tend... that there was a very intense social pressure and rules about how life would be conducted, but it was of women exerting that pressure on another, on one another, and men separately, but of relative autonomy. At least that's my Illichian. Maybe that is you know, I'm sure has issues with it too. It's very broad in general.
Well, I think we tend to read the Victorians back onto basically every period of history, in an incredibly unhelpful and inaccurate way. You know, like every condemnation that people proffer of the Puritans is actually talking about the Victorians. All of the criticisms of, you know, female subjection, like the Victorian era is like unique and weird in.
Oh, no, you cut out right when you were going to tell us about how the Victorian era was unique.
Women were supposed to do. We're in its image of what women were supposed to do, you know, basically as little as possible. But it was a household that required less work to run it than had ever happened before. You know, women were running the household in, you know, early modern England too, but, you know, they didn't have, you know, any of these industrial production. They didn't have any of the, you know, labor saving or outsourcing that Victorian women had. And, you know, so you're left with basically like sitting there and looking pretty, which.
But weren't they doing even more than that?
Satisfying. I'm sorry? Like,
weren't Victorian women playing music and memorizing poetry and doing crafts and being, and were educated in a way that most people today couldn't even imagine being?
It's definitely true of like Georgian women. I think you start in the, maybe this is more of a late Victorian thing, but I think you start at a certain point to have this image of the woman as the refuge from the big, mean, scary world. And, you know, it's nice to have that, but, you know, I think the women who were, you know, having their own, you know, exciting and interesting thought that the new woman was seen as a something, you know, different and new and revolutionary. You know, I don't mean to say that Victorian women were like exclusively ornamental. Obviously they weren't. And obviously, you know, the women who were able to, you know, play this role were only, you know, a certain subset of society. You know, lots of Victorian women were, you know, working in factories or were, you know, working like 14-hour days and cleaning somebody else's house. But the role, the ability for women to participate in, you know, broader society. And you see all these scenes in Jane Austen of the women, you know, chatting and, you know, having these pert arguments or playing music at dinner parties. And in the Victorian era, that becomes increasingly separated. And the women's social lives and the men's social lives kind of withdraw from one another. You know, in the earlier periods, the socializing is much more unified, while the rest of life is much less. So anyway, I think a lot of people criticize traditional gender roles in an incredibly inaccurate way, because you know, traditional gender roles, you know, traditional when, like traditions change, right. Traditional for whom, and there are universal similarities, but there's also tremendous variation within, because different traditions are adaptive in different times and places. And, you know, it's like saying traditional agriculture is bad. Okay, fine. Are we talking like Chinese rice paddies? Are we talking like, you know, corn? Like, you know, these are very different things, even though they have a lot of very clear, meaningful similarities. And, you know, going back to what we were saying before about finding things that fit for you and for your life, like you can say, you know, these traditions encoded something important and meaningful and good. But, you know, the circumstances that gave rise to these traditions are gone. Like, how do we now encode those same truths in a way that works for us? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be the angel in the house without an entire domestic staff. And you can't have an entire domestic staff these days unless you are like so ludicrously wealthy. Like, I don't know, you have your like somebody playing this podcast for you.
And there's, it's interesting. There used to be such a surplus of labor that having, hiring, it wasn't only the super wealthy that hired domestic labor. It was fairly widespread and still is in some countries. Like if you live in Laos or India, you know, if you have any means at all, you probably hire servants.
Yeah, I have a friends here who have what they call a casero, just like they're like a couple who own the land, and then another couple lives in a separate house and runs everything and like cleans their house.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. I have friends who grew up as missionaries in Laos and Vietnam, and so their families did not have much money, but relative to the villages they were in, and they had to hire a servant. It would have been totally socially unacceptable for them not to pay someone. So it's interesting that, you know, we were talking earlier about the hiring out of domestic labor, which certainly now it's like for a house cleaner to come once a week, and mm-hmm. for the landscaping company to come once a week, but without any real responsibility.
Yeah.
And personal relationship and duty to the person you're hiring, much less like in the past. Yeah, like hiring a family where there would be sometimes multi-generational relationships and mutual responsibility and keeping someone on even after they're too old to really work much and all of that. And I think, you know, it's all of these things are tied together. You know, the fact that if you were children, if, you know, fewer laborers, there's not just a surplus of labor. We have a surplus of technology now, but I think that also adds to the, like, in terms of what managing a household once meant for not just wealthy, it meant also being a boss.
Yeah. Our homes are much more private now than they used to be. You know, not just in the sense that, you know, we entertain less, but like it would feel weird to me to have somebody else in my house all day. Because, you know, I want to be able to like wander around in my pajamas and, eat leftover cabbage out of the fridge with a fork if I want to. Like, I would be embarrassed to do that in front of a stranger. I mean, they wouldn't be a stranger. I'd be embarrassed to do that in front of an employee. And just the mere fact that I just used the word employee, you know, that's not the kind of relationship that people who, you know, had domestic staffs had with their servants. You know, it wasn't this very transactional, like, I provide money, you provide services, like, you know, there we are, we're happy, kind of relationship. It was much deeper than that. And I don't mean that in a sort of like, and therefore it was better, because, you know, like they're constantly up in your business and going both ways. You know, there are these scenes in Jane Austen where like they're being very careful not to talk about their business in front of the servants because the servants are going to talk about them. And at the same time, you know, the employers are, you know, very concerned with the moral status and the behavior of their servants. It's a much more intimate relationship than we like to have with people where money is changing hands. You know, like if you're at your office, like we consider it inappropriate for your boss to, you know, tell you what to do in your marriage or how to raise your children. You know, because that's none of their business. That's not, you know, what this, like, exchange-based impersonal relationship is supposed to be. And, you know, there's good and bad there. It's, you know, it's sort of necessary in a society as polarized as ours is, because, you know, you really don't want your boss telling you how to vote. But it's also a kind of relationship, and a kind of relationship that takes up so much of people's lives, that looks only at one very specific aspect of what it is to be human. You know, your professional persona is part of you, but it's not all of you. And it's not some of the most important parts of you. So the kind of relation, you know, spending your life in the kind of relationship where you don't get to, I mean, there's this stupid line about bringing your whole self to work, which like nobody ever actually wants you to do. And
you don't want to do it either.
Right. And you don't want to do it either. But the purely transactional relationships are, you know, dehumanizing in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't, having somebody in your house in sort of your most private and intimate space all day, where you have only that transactional relationship, ruins something about the comfort of your own home. But Americans are really, really uncomfortable with any other kind of relationship when money is changing hands.
Yeah. This is a common sociological concept, the Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft. Gesellschaft is like these atomized relationships, transactional, you know, there's nothing really besides I'm going to pay you for this. And we just kind of keep very strong bounds on that, versus Gemeinschaft, which is like more organic community, more intertwined, but much more complicated. There's like a lot of looseness on one end, but a lot of social rules to like kind of keep that looseness.
Ah. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, well, okay.
That was an accident. Carry on.
And when I first moved to Uruguay, we bought a car here, and after we bought the car, they had so little gas in it, like I think just to let people test drive it, that the guy the like kept like no gas in any of the cars, that after we bought it, the we're driving to like register it, and the guy who's selling cars was like, hey, can you go drive me to this other car that was on a test drive, it ran out of gas, and I had to like go walk, and he just like got in the bed of the truck, and we're like driving the car salesman. And it was like such a culture shock, but like a moment where it's like, okay, well, he doesn't have to be like, I can't ask these people anything because I just sold them a car, and therefore I have to maintain that kind of relationship. It's like, it's okay. Like these situations happen, whatever. Then you can remember the guy, and then there's like this positive thing. And I just want to bring it back to, while we're wrapping up, this concept about the question about like men and women and differences that Donald raised. I just have to bring up this point from this. I know it's like not the topic of this podcast, but we're reading The Need to Be Whole by Wendell Berry, and it's book's not really about women and men at all, but he says this thing that I think is relevant right now. He says like there's four truths about men and women. One, women are physically and sexually different. Two, their role in procreation is a burden. Three, they're sexually attractive to men, which is a danger, because four, they're physically smaller than men. And I think like there's a connection here between homesteading and what's going on in the home and relationships between men and women. There are natural differences that are like material reality differences. And then those influence how we make rules in society around protecting those differences. And I think if we're trying to think about moving forward, an ideal way to move forward is first to recognize that there are differences, and that's good. It actually provides a lot of like interest to life. And then to just think like, you know, moving forward, what are the best ways to, for example, protect physically smaller women from men, in a way that doesn't necessarily bring back the whole, like, women are wards of men and have no rights on their own, you know? So it's like the very doomer optimism question is this one for me. It's, you know, like, but I think the first step is at least to, like, get out of that atomized Gesellschaft point of view where everybody is just kind of like expected to be an automaton and exactly in a role similar to everyone else in the role, as opposed to, like, kind of reforming these messy relationships that are, like, much more complicated, like Donald was saying, but like the rules matter and they are developing for a reason, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that Gesellschaft is part of why it's so difficult for people, for women to think about being home, because that's something that only makes sense as part of a larger whole, right? Mm-hmm. Like being a housewife, I mean, just on, like, a very practical level, like, how are you paying your bills? If, you know, it's just you, it doesn't work. And we spend, you know, the first 20, 25, 30 years of our lives, becoming these autonomous agents, that, you know, growing up, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up is something we ask kids. And what we mean is, what job do you want? Mm-hmm. And, you know, no child's been, I want to be a valuable member of my community. to suddenly turn from that model of life to, you know, I am part of a greater whole and I am part of a system that only makes sense with a partner, is really difficult. It's a massive psychological shift, and it's something that we don't spend a lot of time sort of thinking about or preparing for. And, you know, right, there are all these cliches about how, you know, motherhood is when your heart moves outside your body. But like, they're pointing at something true, which is that once you are part of something greater than yourself, be that a family or, you know, some kind of a thick community, you have to stop thinking of yourself as this, you know, autonomous individual engaged in impersonal exchanges, because there are no impersonal exchanges with a baby. It's incredibly personal, and, you know, it's a matter of survival that it be incredibly personal.
So one maybe final question to wrap things up. I'm curious if just thinking back on your own life, the sort of advice or, I don't know, direction that you would give your teenage self or your early 20s self now, having, you know, reflected on a decade of making a home, which I imagine when you were 19 was not how you imagined you were going to be doing. Someone, I'm curious if you, you know, could kind of throw your mind back to yourself in college, how you would, the advice you give, or how you would pitch your current life to that version of yourself.
You know, this is hard because I made a lot of choices and, did a lot of stuff that, like, if I could go back with my current abstract knowledge, but not, like, specific knowledge, like, I would change. But, like, everything turned out great. Like, I wouldn't actually go back and change, you know, what I did, because I would be afraid that by, like, being less dumb in very particular ways, you know, I would accidentally mess something up. And, like, you know, it's like stepping on the butterfly and then your grandfather, you know, whatever. So it's hard for me
not to change your life, but I'm just picturing a person like yourself at 19, like how you're sitting down for coffee with a student at your alma mater who's curious, you know, about the future or something. Like, what is your pitch or your wisdom that you're sharing?
I think my wisdom that I'm sharing is, you know, the taking care of other people is a valuable use of your time. You know, making a place that, you know, is a sort of secure, stable, comfortable, creating the longhouse is, right. Like this is a whole separate podcast probably. But you know, the making somewhere that is safe and comfortable and, you know, psychologically, stable, or a place that promotes psychological stability is a valuable use of your time. You know, it's not a waste of your degree. And being able to do that for the people you love and for yourself is important. You know, what exactly that's going to look like for you in your life. You know, I can tell you what it looks like for me, but, you know, you're not me and you're not married to my husband, thank God. And I mean, because I want him, not, you shouldn't have him. And so, you know, what works for you is not necessarily what's going to work, or what works for me is not necessarily what's going to work for you. But like, think about your future, not as what achievements are you going to rack up, but what can you offer to the people around you, and what can you make for them? And start thinking now of ways that you can make, you know, skills you can accumulate, ways that you can become flexible, either practically or sort of psychologically, so that when life throws you a curveball, you can roll with it, to mix our metaphors terribly.
That's a great mix. That's awesome. Metaphor.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah.